Good morning, Monterey. You're listening to What's the Point on KRXA 540 AM. My name's Glenn Sadowski from Optimal Health Acupuncture and Bodywork in Monterey. The number here to call if you're interested in calling in and talking to either of our guests this morning is 899-5792. That's 899-5792. And if you're not near, if you need to move away from your radio and go to the internet, you can listen at KRXA540.com. The telephone today, via telephone from Ontario, Canada, and from Arcata, California, I have with me today Lear, Keith, and Eric McBay. Eric McBay is a small farmer from Ontario, Canada. He's a writer. He wrote a book called Peak Oil Survival, and another, he co-authored with Derek Jensen, What We Leave Behind. We interviewed Derek Jensen about a month ago, so here's his co-author on the air with us today. And Lear Keith, who's the author of The Vegetarian Myth and author of a whole host of other books. Together with Derek Jensen, the two of these folks have written a book called Deep Green Resistance. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. Welcome to the show, Lear and Eric.
Thanks very
much. Thanks for having us on.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm very excited. You guys have a book that's coming out shortly. Any particular notion of the date that it's coming out?
That's a really good question. We had some trouble, legal trouble. We had to have the lawyers help us sign off on this. Anyway, the book is basically finished now. We got very good news this weekend, so we're pretty much ready to roll. It'll probably be in production at some point by the end of the week. So give it a month, and we should have these books in hand.
Awesome.
So not too far behind schedule, just a little bit.
Very, very good. I'm looking forward to that. Like I said on my introduction, I just finished reading What We Leave Behind. I have Endgame 1 and Endgame 2 on my desk. I've read your book, The Vegetarian Myth, and I tell everybody I know to read it because I have patients coming in all the time who are either vegetarians, have been vegetarians, and either went gray in their early 20s or don't have enough blood coursing through their veins. So
I use
that book all the time in my clinic. I want to thank you for being on the show today and then just get right into it. The book is called Deep Green Resistance. And just from the title, one may or may not be able to get what it's all about. It's about us, I would say, resisting the corporate factions that be and bringing down the big ones so that we can get back to having a green earth. I'm sure that's sort of where you're going with this, but it's a huge book, over 600 pages, and it's chock full of a ton of information about why it's so important and what it is that we can do. What do you consider to be, How can we start? I know that there's some groups down here. Let me preface this by saying there's some groups down here called Initiative Monterey, and where there's small communities of people are starting to get together and forming little clusters. And I think they're happening all over the country, but I'm not exactly aware of where it's all going down. I think Derek turned me on to it. And there's one in Carmel Valley. There's one in Monterey. There's one in Santa Cruz. So things are starting to happen. And with what's going on in the Mideast right now, I think this is a great time to have a book like this come out. What do you consider to be a resistance movement? I mean, we see it happening now in Egypt. But what is it in your minds?
Well, One big idea that people have got to understand, if we're going to talk about political resistance, what it means is that you identify power. So you figure out how is power structured, who's in charge, how do they use the institutions that they have at their command to get power from the rest of us. And then you try to figure out, well, where are they weak and where are we strong? So what are the weapons we can use? And, you know, when I say weapons, this is a very broad category. I'm not just talking about violence. It may include violence. It may not include violence. But it does include force, and that's the thing. But the people in power do not give up willingly. And there's been a lot of resistance over the last, I'd say, 20 or 30 years on the left in the United States to this concept of actual political resistance, of the concept of, you know, the kind of force that's required to bring down power. And we go into some of the reasons in the book why we think historically that's come about. But the left is going to have to get this together, the environmental movement in particular. All of the strategies that we are being offered to save this planet do not even begin to match the scale of the problem. So we are being lied to by the very people who really should have our best interests and the interests of the planet at heart. And I mean all the major environmental organizations. They are not telling the truth about the seriousness of the situation and what it's going to take to change things such that life might have a chance to continue to exist. So we need to face the facts of how bad this is, and whatever despair, you know, that may bring in us, it doesn't matter. We've got to figure out a way around it. And that's why we wrote this book, was to actually present some solutions that could scale up and match the size of the problem.
And the problem being enormous, right? When we talk about oceans of plastic the size of the state of Texas, what we don't know is that maybe that's not the truth, right? That maybe they're actually balls of plastic in the oceans the size of Africa, not the size of Texas, or several of them the size of Africa.
Yeah, we're basically killing ourselves with plastic. I mean, that's one big problem. But I mean, you could make a list of, you know, biodiversity in deep decline, forest health in deep decline. Oceans are collapsing. And when I say collapsing, I mean the plankton. Plankton is responsible for 2 out of 3 animal breaths on this planet because they make oxygen. If the oceans go down, we go down with them. But this is what we're faced with. And the latest reports on global warming show that in the next 50 to 100 years, this planet may be 16 degrees hotter. That's too hot for animal life, essentially. And there's
right.
not going to be anything left. And so they're calling this the climate holocaust. Everybody who was just born this year is going to be alive to see this. And I don't want to live through that. It's going to be absolute hell. And that's the emergency that we are faced with. And, again, they're not telling the truth about the size of the problem and what it's going to take to dismantle this. I mean, you ask what it is. Yes, it's corporate power. It's bigger. It's industrial civilization. And in the end, it's civilization itself. And that's what we've got to put on the table as, you know, the power structure that needs to be brought down if we're going to save our planet.
Mm-hmm. The left in North America in particular has really recruited to, or has really retreated to, a very small number of possible tactics. And so there's really an emphasis on kind of electoral politics, that we could elect or lobby those who are already in power to do things differently, or the idea of consumerism, that we can kind of buy different things that will be less destructive, and that will be a way of persuading corporations to be less damaging to the planet. But resistance movements and social movements through history have used a very wide variety of tactics to exert power, to come up with community power to try to deal with the oppressive power from those on top. And I think we should make a distinction between dissidence and resistance. You know, dissidence is believing differently from those in power, and resistance is actually trying to do something to dismantle those power structures or to obstruct those in power from exploiting people or destroying the planet. And these tactics that have been used by the left are really the tactics of dissidents, of asking those in power kind of politely to change. And they're not going to change because we ask politely. You know, the history of power in all over the world shows this pretty clearly, that those in power do what they do because they get benefits from it. They get power. They get profit. And if we want to, you know, change that from happening, then we have to really look at not methods of persuasion, but methods of political force.
Correct. So this is what that leads us to the next question, which is, why isn't personal lifestyle change enough? In my own practice, you know, I practice, I eat organic. I have on my website where to shop for the local farmers markets, how to make people healthy one patient at a time, kind of a thing. But this, you know, this isn't enough. It's not enough that people start buying organic food and start reusing their plastic bags. There's way more that needs to happen, and it needs to happen in a hurry. That's where you're coming from, right?
That's right, yes. You know, speaking for myself, I'm an organic farmer. We grow most of our own food. We live very lightly. And I love, you know, going out and looking at our ducks in the ponds or the cows in the fields. But in the long term, none of that is going to survive if we can't stop catastrophic global warming, for one example of many. And I think when we're talking about, you know, personal change or even community change, you know, lifeboats or kind of alternative communities, what we have to remember is that only 500 years ago, you you know, this entire continent was covered with thousands or tens of thousands of many different indigenous communities which had different cultures. Some of them were democratic, some less so, but they were all very sustainable. And those cultures were marginalized or wiped out by civilization, by the invasion of these European societies. And just being alternative and just being sustainable is not enough.
Yes, no, absolutely right, because people have been sustainable and have minded their own business, so to speak, for thousands and thousands of years until something went wrong somewhere, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows where it really went wrong, but at some point something went wrong. I mean, it happened in Europe thousands of years ago, but the Aztecs and the Incas also had their pitfalls and civilizations that rose and fell. So is it civilization in and of itself that's the issue here, like you talk about, and what we leave behind? And how can we start to look for a solution to what is the problem, which is organized civilization?
Well, I would say that, go ahead, Eric, and then I'll talk.
I would use civilization as a general term for many different power structures. So, you know, when someone becomes an activist for the first time, let's say against Walmart, they're upset about what Walmart does in their community. So they start being, you know, organizing against Walmart. And then they realize, oh, well, maybe, you know, it's not just Walmart. Maybe it's all corporations that have these problems. And then maybe they say, oh, well, maybe it's not just corporations. It's capitalism. And I think people, as they are, you know, committed activists over time, often develop this deeper critique of power structures. And the term civilization is a term that I use for, you know, the main hierarchical power structures in society. So it's a combination of capitalism, of industrialism, of different political states, of, you know, social or cultural elites. I would distinguish it from land-based cultures. So, you know, land-based cultures might be pastoral, they might be, you know, what we would call indigenous cultures, but they live within their means and they have kind of face-to-face communities that tend to be more democratic, whereas civilizations are what I would call cultures of occupation, is that they tend to, you know, engage in conquest and colonialism, and they live outside of the means of their land base. They consume more than their land base can sustain, so they have to go and kind of pillage resources from other people in other parts of the world.
Good. Leah?
Yeah, I was going to take this somewhere else. I'm really glad that he laid that all out. Because you said, well, what can people do about it? And, you know, throughout time, you sort of always have these two different wings of any resistance movement. And the first wing builds toward the new world that you want to bring into being. And so their job, you know, is the culture of resistance. And that usually includes things like local economies that are sustainable and just. It includes some kind of participatory democracy, so new civic institutions where everybody gets a voice, gives people control over their lives. Definitely systems of justice, new ones that actually work and that will settle disputes and conflicts in an orderly fashion. And then there is a part of this that's about character building, that's about self-respect and reclamation of, you know, your inner psyche that breaks through denial and that gives people back their self-respect after living under oppression. And then the final thing that they do is direct support for that frontline resistance. And that's the other part of this, is that you need that resistance. And those are the people that actually do organized political resistance. They come into, you know, they purposely take on power in some way and try to dismantle. So you've got the one set of people doing those direct confrontations and the dismantling, and then you've got the other people getting ready for the new society that you want to bring into being. In the book, we talk about, you know, two pretty good examples that we walk people through historically, one being the original American Revolution and the other being the Irish resistance to the English. And both of these examples really stand out as, you know, how this entire process works. But those are the two things that you need sort of in place if a resistance is going to be successful. One or the other will not do it. And, you know, we try again and again throughout the book and when we do talks to try to, you know, break down this dichotomy that's been set up between, you know, this sort of dropout alternative culture versus a sort of hyper-political culture, because you need both. You need, and they have to accept each other as necessary wings for the bird to fly. And so right now what we have on the left is an alternative culture. And a lot of it is apathetic or even hostile to the concept of political engagement. And that has to change. And what we really need is an oppositional culture. So we need this culture of resistance that will actively and very consciously embrace the concept of resistance. And this is really a call to the people who are involved in things like the Transition Town movement and permaculture. I feel like a lot of those people are part of that alternative. And I want them to broaden out and start to think about this concept of being in opposition to the powers that be, because simply dropping out and making really nice gardens isn't going to do it. Not while our collective garden is being dismantled, you know, systematically around the globe. We are going to have to take on those powers, and we are going to have to do something about them. And it's fine if people decide that personally they belong in the culture part of this. It's great. We need that work too. But they have to stop saying that resistance isn't possible, because a lot of them do that. They need to be actively embracing this idea of resistance and encouraging it in whatever way they can.
Excellent, excellent. So this talk about apathy and that we need to be more active. And when I was in college, it was the late 70s, early 80s, and I spent some time in jail doing civil disobedience. And we had pretty decent numbers. I mean, we had 2,000 or 3,000 people at some of these events, and we actually did a lot of great work in Southern California and Central California from, you know, folks coming from all over California and Nevada to go to these acts of civil disobedience. And yet nowadays, I don't hear about it in the United States at all. And I'm wondering if the new kind of like the new young group of kids who are in their late teens and early 20s right now are just so overly stimulated and plugged in with all the different technologies that we have this day that we didn't have then, that they're not willing to step out of the culture that they're in and go and see what's possible out there if they get together in large groups.
Yeah, I think that a lot of the connections between the different generations have been really broken, and that's done very purposely by corporate America. But any successful resistance movement is always intergenerational, and that's for a really good reason. The older people can do long-term planning.
Right.
That's what your brain is good at when you're middle-aged. The young people can't do that. In fact, you know, your sense of time is not actually fully developed till you're 21. It's just not what the adolescent brain does. They cannot understand, you know, cause and effect or kind of consequences. But what they do have is that incredible moral vigor. That is really the gift of youth. They've got all that fire. They've got all that idealism. If you put those two things together, you've got an unstoppable movement. But every time corporate America, I mean, they figured this out. If they broke the links between the young and the old, you know, it means that there will never be a serious resistance movement, because you need both ends of that. You need the long-range planning, the people who can add the stability, and then you need that, you know, that fiery input from the youth who think, we can do this, you know, don't be depressed. It's possible. And when they break those links, it means that that movement can never form. And corporate America has been really good at that, and they've created this really repulsive culture that's taken over, that has trained us all just to be stupid and cruel, essentially. And it's very addictive stuff. So
it really is. We need to go to a break. We got Bob Marley coming up in the background. When we come back from the break, we'll continue. And if you have any questions, you can call in. We're at 899-5792. Be right back. Oh, welcome back. You're listening to What's the Point on KRXA 540 AM. I'm on the phone with Lear Keith and Eric McBay, authors of Deep Green Resistance. We've been so far chatting it up all morning about their book and what their strategies are for returning the Earth to a green and sane environment. Not the easiest challenge in the world, probably the most difficult challenge that we've come up to as a species on the planet. We were talking a little bit about how we need to bring a lot of new work needs to come up. And I was taking this workshop last weekend, and the two of you may be able to appreciate this. And this just relates to people in general and how we as health practitioners go about healing our patients. And that is that there are really three things that need to occur. One is you need to bring in good. Two is you need to get rid of the bad. And three is you need to wait and have time. And I think that that's really kind of in a nutshell what needs to happen here on a global scale. I do it at my office one patient at a time, but on a global scale, the question is time. How much time do we have to before it's too late? It's what a lot of the kids are asking these days, I think.
Yeah. Well, you know, just as one example, every single day, 200 species go extinct. So for them, it's too late.
You can talk up a little bit more. Go ahead. Yeah.
It's too late. If 200 species are going extinct every day, it's over for them.
Right.
So what we have to do is, you know, remember that those species, those animals, those plants, they're our kin, and we need to fight for them like we would for our own families.
Yeah, exactly. And we haven't taken that into account over the course of the last 50 or 100 years in the industrialization of the world, that whenever we pave a road, whatever was there will never be there again until the road gets torn back up and something else can replace it. And whenever we put up a building, the same thing happens. Whenever we build a nuclear power plant, we've got miles and miles and miles that are endangered if there's ever a spill. And the local area right there that may be polluted for the rest of eternity, as far as we know.
Right.
And so as far as time goes, we have this enormous, enormous problem. We call it global warming, but we also have the, you know, that it's all tied in together with the plastics and the overconsumptiveness of oil and the overconsumptiveness of minerals from the planet. The basic foundation of where the book seems to be leading is that we need to get back to more tribal living standards, where we're within carrying capacity of our families. Yes or no?
Eric, you go ahead.
I think yes. Well, that's part of it, is the human scale kind of land-based culture. And of course, as we've been saying, you know, that really has to be combined with the other active part of the resistance movement. That's just as you were saying after the break, you know, getting the good in and getting the bad out in time. It's that, you know, the human scale democratic cultures are really part of getting the good in, and then that more confrontational wing is about getting the bad out. And time, of course, is the big issue that we have. I think we sometimes assume that, you know, the truth will win out given enough time, we'll be able to do enough kind of public education work, and that's the basis of a lot of different environmental campaigns. But if you actually look at public opinion surveys on things like global warming, in many countries, the people are much less concerned about global warming now than they were, say, 3 or 4 or 5 years ago. So we have to be aware that, you know, that education doesn't necessarily just kind of bring about this enlightened state, that we require a combination of different actions. And the struggles of the suffragists in England are maybe a good example of how militants can help spur more action. Leah, did you want to talk about the Women's Social and Political Union?
Yeah, it's a really interesting case study and one that's, of course, very close to my heart. But, you know, they had been trying for 2 generations to get some kind of political standing for women, especially in England. And, you know, their first big victory was the Married Women's Property Act, because up until then, women literally did not own the clothes on their backs. Men owned everything, including the women. And that was a huge, and that made a huge impact when they were able to get that. And so from there, they were hoping to jimmy this up into, okay, and now we're actually citizens and we get to vote. And, you know, so for 2 generations, they really tried to do this by persuasion, by going over and over to these members of parliament and basically begging, you know, please, 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 see us as human beings, please, can we vote? And, you know, they didn't get anywhere. So finally, Emmeline Pankhurst, who was raised in a culture of resistance. I mean, she writes in her memoir about how she, as a child, was taken to abolition movements and was taken to suffrage movements, and she was read Uncle Tom's Cabin was her bedtime story as a child, and how she well knew the meaning of the word slavery and emancipation. This was just, you know, what she was breathing when she grew up. I mean, this is the culture that she grew up in, and so she was meant for the struggle. So, you know, she went ahead, she married James Pankhurst, who was the guy who actually authored the Married Women's Property Act, and they had a bunch of kids, and her 2 daughters rose to the struggle as well. So the 3 of them, her and her 2 daughters, there's this great moment where, I mean, I just love the story, where Christabel's about 10 years old, and she turns to her mom and she says, "Mother, how long you women have been trying to get the vote. For my part, I intend to win it." And Emmeline writes in her journal, "Is there a difference between trying to get it and actually getting it? And this is what we're going to have to do. I've got to take the strategic smarts of the women of my generation and put it together with these young, fearless women. And if we can do that, we will make an organization that can win, which is exactly what she did. And hence was born the Women's Social and Political Union, and this was the organization that drove the suffrage cause forward and ultimately won the vote. And they gave up right away on the persuasion it wasn't going to work. They could see that. And Christabel says, you know, we wandered for 40 years in the political wilderness. It didn't matter. Ultimately, we had to use force. So they start having these massive civil disobedience campaigns. They interrupt every single, you know, anytime anybody's up for parliament, they would just hound them with shouting out from the audience, you know, votes for women, where do you stand on women's suffrage? They were, you know, dragged off to jail, and then they would do hunger strikes as political prisoners. They were tortured in jail. And it just kept escalating because the more militant they got, the more women joined. And that's the amazing thing is, you know, everybody's so afraid, oh, if you step out of line, you're going to alienate. It's not what happened. You know, there's 500 or 600 other suffrage societies sprang up pretty much overnight. It reinvigorated the entire movement, and the Pankhursts were adored by their followers. I mean, they were the leaders of that movement, and women would just throw themselves bodily between the Pankhursts and Harm, and there are all these wonderful anecdotes about the ways they tried to keep the leadership safe because they were so adored and under so much pressure constantly from the police. And anyway, so they went on to do other things as well. I mean, they did escalate even further beyond civil disobedience when that wasn't working. They moved on to arson. So they blew up things like golf courses and train stations and historic buildings. So, and the thing to remember is that they were encumbered by 40 pounds of skirting. They had to wear corsets, and you could not appear in public as a respectable woman without a corset. So they couldn't breathe. And yet they're running, you know, over the gorse, you know, being chased by police, scaling fences, encumbered in these ways, and they still managed to do it. So they blew things up and burned things down, and in the end they won. But every time they escalated, they had more followers, not fewer.
Exactly. So they pushed the envelope so that what was not normal, was not like an above-ground acceptable thing to do, became above-ground and became public, and more people could join in and feel safe. We have somebody on the line who wants to ask a question. Ready?
Sure.
Okay. She disappeared.
Oh, well.
Either that or I disappeared her. It's one of those magic things, these boards and all these buttons that acupuncturists don't really clue in all the time. If I had somebody screening my calls, it would be better. So if you want to try calling back in, that'd be great. I don't even know if I can handle three callers at once, but we'll try if you want to call in. It's 899-5792. Anyway, you talk about it in your book. Let me get to the right page here. You have two different goals. One is to, for this grand strategy, to disrupt and dismantle industrial civilization, to remove the ability of the powerful to exploit the marginalized and destroy the planet. And the second goal, which depends on and assists the first, is to defend and rebuild just, sustainable, autonomous human communities, and as a part of that, to assist in the recovery of the land. Now, this caller's trying to get back in. I'm going to try to squeeze her in, okay?
Okay.
Hello, this is KRXA. You're on live.
Hi. I just wanted to make a short comment. I admire these people, what they're doing. People that have this vision or their kind of vision have always been at the forefront of any movement. And it's interesting that you said that, you know, you were practicing civil disobedience in the 70s and 80s in Los Angeles, which is around the time that I was there. And we've accomplished a lot, but I want to just... connect the dots. What I'm seeing now in so many young people, and we still have people who are working hard, and there will always be. But if you look at, you know, like the people that they're holding up as idols now, I mean, the people that are constantly in and out of jail for drugs and this and that, and yet we see them constantly as though they were some sort of hero. So I think the time has run out. I mean, you know, they're constantly letting us know that there's no wealth for them, there's no future for them. And this can't be. I believe that this bubble is about to burst. I don't quite know, but I just feel it. And I think that these people that are on, you know, have worked their vision, and they've come a long way, and they're still working. And I appreciate your having them on and giving them an audience, and I just hope that they continue to carry their message.
Thank you.
All right.
Go ahead. You want to respond to that or just... give thanks.
I could only hear every other word, so I actually have no idea what she said. I'm so sorry. Maybe Eric was able to hear it better.
Yeah, well, I think one of the things that she was talking about was the fact that, to paraphrase, I don't think she has a lot of hope in young people today actually, you know, taking action to change things positively. And I think, you know, in many cases that's true, but resistance movements don't depend on, 50% or 60% or 70% of the population. Usually in historical resistance movements, you only have a few percent of the population that's actually active in that movement. And they have a big impact because they're very strategic and they, choose their tactics properly. So they don't actually need a huge number. They have many people supporting them. But that small group just tries to be as effective as it can be. And I think that there are a lot of young people who are really concerned and thoughtful about these problems, but that the solutions that are being offered by kind of established organizations and NGOs are not solutions that are effective and not solutions that are appropriate to the scale of the problems that we're talking about here today. And I think that, in a way, there's been kind of a culture of defeat that's set in on the left because there have been, few substantial victories in a long time. But as soon as you do have effective action and as soon as you do have victories, I think that people really take up those models and are inspired by those models. The situation in Tunisia that's provoked huge uprisings in Egypt and other countries in that area are a really good example of what can happen when people actually start to be effective.
Yes, I would agree. I think that you're mentioning of that the fact that we only need a small percentage of people to be very, very effective in this type of a resistance movement is spot on, because it would seem to me like that a lot of these military establishments and a lot of the big energy companies are probably not the most difficult places to target if people were going to be going out there and starting to dismantle things, that they're not necessarily all that well heavily guarded or very or watched over the way they would need to be if there was going to be a real resistance.
Right, and two of the examples that we use in the book, one is the nonviolent version and one is the more militant version, but the basic thing that you learn when you are either in guerrilla training camp or the U.S. military is to target infrastructure, because if you can, especially the energy infrastructure, because if you can do that, you've knocked out, your enemy. And industrial civilization is highly dependent on basically two things, natural gas and oil. And if you were in the military of any kind, you would learn that. This is what our tax dollars teach people.
Exactly.
And it's the reason they do it is because it works. These principles have been honed for decades. And it's a very simple strategy, and this is why, it doesn't matter whether you find the group heinous or whether you agree with their goals. It's what people do because it's effective. And so two of the examples we talk about are, the first one is the strike that just happened in France in October. Now this was, working people striking to protect their rights, so it wasn't exactly the same issue as what we're concerned with, but nevertheless, in 10 days, they shut down pretty much the entire economy of France, and they did that by blockading the oil depots and the oil refineries, and there were, I think, 7 depots in France, so all it took was a few thousand people willing to stand there or park their trucks in front of it, and nobody could get in or out, and the entire economy just starts to grind to a halt very slowly, so this could be done almost overnight if you had enough people. And nobody got hurt. It was a very nonviolent thing to do. It's your basic blockade. But it wasn't symbolic. They meant to stop the economy
exactly.
To make their point.
Right.
And the other group that we talk about is MEND, and this is the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta. That started as a nonviolent movement. It was Ken Sarawiwa's group in the Niger Delta. And Ken Sarawiwa and 8 of his friends were all murdered by the military junta there to great outcry around the world by human rights workers, but they were not able to save his wife. He was murdered for his work trying to stop Dutch Royal Shell. It destroyed the Niger Delta. I mean, it used to be this really lush wetland of, lots of fish and things to eat, and the people were very self-sustaining and well-nourished, and it's been absolutely devastated by the oil companies. And, of course, they've never gotten even a dime of that money locally. So this was a popular uprising to try to change things nonviolently. It didn't work nonviolently. So the next generation is this group called MEND, and they trained themselves to use speedboats and military strategy, and they attack the infrastructure. And in one attack last month in December, they were able to shut down 80% of the oil economy of Nigeria in one series of attacks. It was over 1 week, which is to say that this infrastructure is immensely vulnerable, and if we meant business, we could be thinking like field generals, instead of I don't know what it is we're thinking like. I guess it's just magical thinking at this point. But it would be very doable. And we keep being, you know, everyone tries to tell us it can't be done, it can't be done, resistance isn't possible, it's too big. It's not true. Because people around the world, people with a lot less money than any of us, have managed to do this. And there's no reason that, I mean, really the only question is, are we going to join them?
Right, right. And that would take us into our next topic of conversation, which I want to get to after the next break. We're going to go to a quick break and we talk about like how pissed off people really need to get and how bad does it really need to get before people besides you guys write books and I have a radio show with you on it, and how bad does it need to get before people start taking it to the streets and actually doing what needs to be done rather than just thinking about what needs to be done. We'll be back in just a minute with Lier, Keith, and Eric McFay. Welcome back. You're listening to What's the Point on KRXA. I'm with Lier Keith and Eric McBay, co-authors with Derek Jensen of Deep Green Resistance. We've been talking about the book and about what people need to do. Right before we went to the break, we asked the question, how pissed off do people need to get? How many, like in What We Leave Behind, you talk about how many percent of the salmon are going to need to be dead before somebody makes a huge stand about it? How many percent of the redwoods are going to have to go down? How many percent of the forests are going to have to be completely clear cut? How many mountains in Africa are going to have to be mined before people get pissed off enough? And I think we all have our own levels of how bad it's got to get. My wife and I were talking this morning over a cup of tea before I was on my way over here about how in your book, you talk about how peak oil is now, like for the next 5 to 10 years. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but my sense is that in America, people are going to have to be without food and water before they get pissed off enough. They're not going to be looking outside and see if there's any problems with the fish or with other animals and other species. That Americans have just grown too accustomed to being so self-centered and unaware of what's going on around them that they're going to have to be without food and water before they get pissed off enough.
I'm afraid that I mostly agree with you that I think that's true across the board for resistance movements. People really have to suffer before they're going to be willing to take on power, because taking on power is really scary. So you have to weigh the costs and the benefits. And right now in the United States, I mean, we live in a militarized barricade, and we get all the goodies from around the world. You know, we're the 5% that get all this stuff, the cheap plastic crap. So it feels real comfortable, you know. And getting people to actually take these kinds of risks when their lives feel so comfortable is really hard. I live in the United States myself, obviously, and I only speak English. So the only you know, access I have to this is to write the book I did in English. But I have a lot more hope for other countries for that reason. They're not as comfortable. It's really hard to get people to consider putting their lives at risk when they've got food and they've got running water and hot water on demand and flush toilets and refrigerators, and like people feel happy with what they've got.
Chocolate and coffee. Yeah.
You got it. And the truth that nobody will say out loud is that, you know, for us to be living sustainably means that our standard of living is going to have to drop to that of Sri Lanka. That's really the amount of solar energy we're allowed per day without doing drawdown on the planet. And no politician is going to get elected by saying that. I mean, nobody in the United States wants to hear that. But it is the truth.
Well, yeah, the truth is that people are going to have to die in order for other species to survive. We can't keep up with the numbers that we have. It's just impossible. It's impossible. People are going to have to die either because we're not producing as many, or because there's disease, or because there's going to be war, or because there's going to be famine or natural disasters. But there's just way too many people on the planet for us to be able to maintain any semblance of the current lifestyle that we have in America. Now, even at the level of standard of living of, let's say, Sri Lanka, are there too many people on the planet right now?
I would say yes. Eric, do you want to take this one?
In the long term, I think that's probably the case. But, you know, if we're talking about runaway global warming, for example, you know, we could reach tipping points for that in a matter of years if we haven't already. And the primary issue in the short term is not people, it's consumption. That there's a small, you know, minority of the planet's population that's using almost all of the petroleum, that's emitting almost all of the greenhouse gases. And so some of these other, you know, kind of the longer-term problems we can deal with in the future, but only if we, you know, deal with problems like the more urgent kind of catastrophes that are looming. And I think one of the reasons that we wrote this book was because of the idea that, you know, as we were just discussing, that people in the industrialized world, the people who are in the most privileged positions, have such a strong sense of entitlement that a mass movement is never going to develop in time. And so if we want to save lives in the long term, both human and non-human, then we have to empower the group of people who are actually willing to undertake serious resistance in the short term.
Right. So I guess my next question is, as I go kind of like I skim through some of what you sent down to me, is that you have these strategies that you mention at the end of the book, strategies A through, is it E or F? I can't. It's E. Engage in attacks on infrastructure, aid in participating, ongoing social and ecological struggles and justice struggles. And one of them is rebuild a sustainable subsistence base for human societies, including perennial polycultures for food and localized democratic communities that uphold human rights, build and mobilize resistance organizations that will support all of the above activities, which is, you know, defending the land and making the land what it really is, which is our mother. Our small affinity groups and transition groups and these little initiative groups that are starting to pop up across California and the West Coast, is this a good start? Do you feel it's a good start?
I do. I think that there's the seed of something really important, and because these are the jobs that the, you know, the culture of resistance is always charged with, and they've got part of it right. The problem, I mean, the place where this is going off track, is that they see themselves as alternative and not as oppositional, that they're not taking up a call to actually do direct confrontations with power. And I just feel like if they could bring that into their analysis and really support the front-run resistance movement, that together those two wings could be very successful. And so this is really more of an invitation than a criticism, that I hope that they will consider putting, you know, direct political organizing back on the table as, you know, something that's going to have to happen if we're actually going to save the planet. Because all the cute little gardens in the world aren't going to save us as the planet is plundered. I mean, it's we can turn our backs on it, but global warming will come home. So,
right.
You know, the people in charge, you know, as Utah Phillips famously said, they have names and addresses, and we could stop them if we would simply name them and name the system that we're living under. It's, you know, it's not that hard, as we've shown. It's, you know, there are people around the world who have brought the oil economy to a halt when they wanted to. So
exactly.
We could be doing the same thing.
Yes. And in America, it's like we just recently said, it seems like we're going to have to, it's going to take some time before enough people get pissed off that the numbers are large enough where we see civil disobedience and or some sort of direct opposition where corporations are under attack and are being brought to a halt. It would seem to me like when we talked about global warming, we say when Eric was mentioning it, only a small percentage of people are consuming and creating global warming. That, to me, that means the corporations like Westinghouse and GE and Monsanto, not necessarily you or I.
Exactly.
Just because
yeah.
we live in America. I mean, I live as simply as I can, but I had to drive here today to get to
right.
do this radio station, and we have to have some sort of electricity to monitor everything that's going on these phone conversations. So I think we're talking about the big companies, and my dad worked for Bechtel the whole
right.
time I was growing up, and that's one of the reasons why I did civil disobedience when I was in college.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's going to have to, and we weren't hungry when I went to jail for 12 days. I didn't have no food, no water. There wasn't any real threat other than the fact that I thought that the nuclear power plant on a active earthquake fault line was a stupid idea, and so did several thousand other people.
Right.
Right.
Well, this is, you know, I say I'm always after the 2% because I think it only takes 2% of any group to actually do that front line resistance. And I know they're out there. They just need a rallying cry. They need a strategy that will take them from A to B, and that's what we've tried to provide in the book. And that 2%, and those are always the people that are willing to do all the risks.
Go to jail for their beliefs or actually put their lives on the line, like the gentleman in Tiananmen Square.
Exactly.
You know, that kid is famous for eternity.
Right? Pac-Man, yeah, he is. We don't even know his name, and, you know, we all know his picture.
So we have about 4 more minutes. Let's tidy things up. Let's mention a couple of things that you guys are doing in the near future. Your book's coming out. It's called Deep Green Resistance. It should be available in bookstores and on Amazon.com and Borders or wherever at some point pretty soon. You have a talk in Arcata on the 15th, but really closer to us, Friday, February 18th, you're in Oakland, California, Lear.
That's right.
And you're speaking at the Humanist Hall in Oakland. And on February 19th, you're also speaking at Artist Television Access in San Francisco. And then you'll be in Eugene with
Derek and Eric.
And Eric in March, the beginning of March, the 3rd through the 6th in Eugene, Oregon. Is that through a university or something like that?
Yeah, it was a big conference at the University of Oregon at Eugene every year. That's the huge environmental law conference. So we're sort of kicking off the book at that point because we'll all three be together, which is sort of rare. So
that's great.
It's a great event every year that's always really radical speakers, and I'm just so thrilled that you know, we're hopefully all going to be there.
My daughter's considering that as one of her school of choice.
Yeah.
But she's like, it's so wet. I'm like, what? What? It's not necessarily what's important. I guess what's important is sun and warm winters, you know. You got to go to the right place where you're going to be and are surrounded by the right types of people.
Right.
And I think a lot of kids really need to understand that. If they're going to make a difference in the world for, like if my kids are going to make a big difference in the world, they have to surround themselves with friends their own age and adults who can be role models for them, like the two of you and Derek and other people that we know who can engage them in learning how to make a huge difference on the planet. Because it isn't the people like me who do acupuncture or somebody down the road who's an organic farmer that are making the big difference. It's what's going to make a big difference is people actually putting themselves on the line, and that's going to have to happen in my estimate, you know, probably before my grandchildren are born, you know.
Right. And out of time.
Yeah. It's a lot for people to chew on. It really is, and it brings up a lot in a human being to think that we have taken this global warming to the point we're like on the edge of a cliff as a human race. But
and as a planet, it's not even just humans.
It's hard for me to get used to the linguistics of it all, but as a planet, we're on the edge of this cliff. Yet, you know, to me today, Super Bowl Sunday in America, it doesn't feel like that.
Right.
It doesn't feel like that at all. I don't know if it feels like that in Arcata or in Ontario, but it doesn't feel like we're on the edge of a cliff. You know, there's no immediate threat. And I think that's what people, they don't get that there is an immediate threat. You know, there is an immediate threat. There aren't salmon coming out of the ocean to feed us anymore. They're not hopping out of the oceans anymore. They're hiding what's left of them, right?
Yeah.
Been a pleasure. Anything you two would like to add before we wrap it up?
Well, I think that, you know, as we've been discussing, time is short. And so I think it's important for everyone who's listening to think about the world that you want to leave for future generations and to think about what the most effective action that you can take is and to find a group, find your comrades, and to fight for the planet.
Right. There are groups here. I'm looking into getting involved with a transitions group from Monterey and Carmel Valley. I know there's one in Santa Cruz. And if anybody wants to get information about that, they can call me at the office at Optimal Health Acupuncture or go to www.optimalhealthmonterey.com to get in touch with me. And I want to thank you both so much for being on the show. It's going to be archived on my website within a week. And you can both get a copy if you'd like. I'll email them to you later on in the week.
Thank you so much.
Have a great day.
Bye.
Have a great...